Now, I'm not going to ask you for verbal input, but I want you to think for a moment. As you look back in your life, what are the most important days of your life? Okay? Just think about it for a moment. If you were to, say, narrow down to two or your top two or top three, I mean, it could be any number of things. Some of you might say, oh, it was the day when I got married. That would certainly be the right answer if your spouse is here. Right? It might be maybe the birth of your first child. Maybe it was the day when your kids actually graduated. It could be any number of things. Maybe it was your first job, your first car. I mean, there could be any number of things. But what are the significant days of your life? And, of course, some of you, and I hope all of us, are thinking of, you know, certain very significant spiritual experiences. Maybe the day you came to Christ or, you know, something that just really, really impacted you in a big way. Now, I want to think this morning of important days. And we're going to start off thinking about two, but I want us to move into understanding the importance of three, of what I'm going to call most important days of your life. Now, Mark Twain, remember the writer of Huckleberry Finn, Tom Sawyer, and so on. He was an American writer, humorist. He said this, and many people have quoted him, and it's worth thinking about. He said that, you know, the two most important days of your life are the day that you were born, and the second day is the day you understand why. So think about that for a moment, okay? And in some ways, there's a lot of truth to that, don't you think? The day that you're born, I mean, that's a day to celebrate. By the way, at Trinity, if we happen to know it's your birthday, we sing to you, right? And if some of you parade the fact that it's your birthday because you want us to sing to you, and others of you do your very best to hide it because you don't want us to sing to you. By the way, anyone's birthday today? All right. Now that's kind of a nice thing that we can do in a church like ours. And so certainly a birthday is an important one. And we do that here. But when we think of it, you know, Psalm 139, for example, talks about how every single one of us, you know, from all the way from conception until natural death, is valued by God. You know, the whole debate that's going on in the United States, that's kind of coming up again as everybody is grappling with this whole issue of abortion and so on. We know from Scripture that every single human being has value, has dignity, is made in the image of God. You know, people are trying to persuade us that we are just an accident, that your life is just purely random, that, you know, we're some kind of, you know, evolution somehow was the answer to all of this. And Psalm 139 says, all the days of my life were what? Were put in your book, ordained before even a single one of them came to be. I was knit together in my mother's womb. You know, your works are incredible, Lord. And all of your works, you know, they give glory to you. So we know these things. So it's a good thing to know. But the real question then is, well, what about the second question? You know, the most important day for us initially is our birth, but Twain says, well, yeah, but it's also the reason why. Now, I think we're going to discover in a few moments that second question is really not enough, because we're going to have a third question, and I'm going to put the third question smack in the middle of the first and the third, and you're going to see why in just a few moments. I mean, it's a good thing to know the reason. Don't you want to have a reason for living? Think of how many people right now, particularly young adults, are grappling with that very issue. They really don't have a great reason for living. And many of them are declaring that lack of purpose and value by just taking their own lives. We need to have something to live for. And now it's a good thing to know. It's a good thing to know your passions. And most people today, they'll take this second question, not just your birth, but the reason for it. And most people will just take it into, well, in a sense, making it into a nice, good Disney movie plot. Discover and follow your dreams. and it sells well. And there are all kinds of people that will go with that. Now, it's good to find your life partner. It's good to have a passion for what you do. All of these things are good. But here's the challenge. Is life just about finding Mr. and Mrs. Right? Or finding the right job? How do we prevent? I mean, it's a good thing if your passion becomes something that is other-oriented. And we're doing something. Maybe it's a great social cause. Or it's something, it's your job, and you're doing something, and your passion is not just to make money, but to do something, to contribute in some way. But how do we prevent that second question from just becoming self-absorption? How do we prevent it from just becoming that my whole life purpose is ultimately just about me, about my happiness, my fulfillment? What about if we take this as our ethical compass? And what if we say, well, the whole purpose for my life is ultimately just to find my reason for living? And what if there's no moral boundaries or guideline? How do we prevent it from becoming what so often it becomes when sometimes people will say something, and I've had them say it to me. They've maybe said it to you. Come on. How can this be wrong? It feels so right. So how do we get beyond that second question? Remember the famous statement of Augustine when he said this. He said, "You have made us for yourself, O God. And our hearts are what? Our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you." Remember Pascal, mathematician, philosopher, who said it like this, that God has put within every single human heart a God-shaped vacuum, right? That ultimately only God can fill. And so it really isn't enough to just have two questions to guide your life. It's not enough just to say, you know, the two most important days of your life are the day that you're born. I mean, that's good. It's an important day. It's not enough to have even the second day that says the reason why. But you need a third day. And the third day, which I'm going to put in the middle, not just the day you're born, but the day you have a deep and personal and transformational encounter with the living God through Jesus Christ. And when you have that second day, that also enables you to answer that third question, which is what? Why am I here? And unless you have that deep personal encounter with God, you're going to just be fumbling throughout your life trying to figure it out. And you're going to be listening to whatever is the current trend, and you're going to be just kind of having your, you know, whatever the wind is going, you're going to go that direction because there's really no moral compass. There's nothing to guide you. And so what we see as we move into this particular text today, and I started with a little longer introduction, but I want you to kind of get a sense of where we're going and then see how in the life of Moses, all three of these interconnect very well. So let's pick it up, first of all, but we have to start all the way back in chapter 1, verse 22. We're going to survey quickly, well, somewhat quickly, chapter 2, and then we're going to get into chapter 3. So we're covering a lot of ground over the next few minutes. Let's pick it up at verse 22 of chapter 1. This is talking just before the birth of Moses. Pharaoh gave this order to all of his people, every Hebrew boy that is born, "You must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live." Now, remember, we talked about that a little last week. And we talked about this epic battle between good and evil that's all the way through the book of Exodus. Pharaoh thinks that he's in charge and he's the one that is doing all that he can to, first of all, slow down the population growth of the Israelites in Egypt. It's not working. And so now, of course, what does he do? He begins to advocate genocide. You would think that Pharaoh was a pretty brilliant man, But he's actually pretty dumb. Does he realize that you're not going to win a fight against God? And I want you all of us to think about that. Think of an area of your life where either in the past or maybe it's right now. Think of where you find yourself wanting to assert your own independence and you think you've got everything under control and you think you can take charge. But if you really are honest, you recognize, wait a minute, I'm fighting against God and this is a battle that I'm not going to win. Remember Gamaliel in the book of Acts chapter 5. When the Sanhedrin were telling Peter and the apostles and said, look, you know, stop teaching in the name of Jesus. And what does Gamaliel say? I advise you, leave them alone, let them go. If their purpose is of human origin, it will fail. But if it's from God, you will not be able to stop it. You're only going to be found fighting against God. So if there's some of that in your life, I mean, just listen to these words. We're not going to win the battle. Remember another one, and we'll just summarize this, Nicholas, and that is in Luke 19. But remember the parable of the 10 minas. And you've got this king, he goes away for a while, and he distributes 10 minas. A mina was a form of currency. It was equivalent to about 3 months' wages. And he says, look after this. And he said, until I come back. And then it says that his subjects hated him in verse 14. And they said, we don't want this man to be our king. By the way, that's so much of what is going on, not only in the battles I experience in my own life, but in the battles that we're experiencing in our culture right now as well. It's so much of this is to say, no, I want to be in charge. I don't want to be under authority. I want to be able to govern my life based on my pleasure, what feels good for me, what is right to me. Remember, we've talked about this. If we were to summarize the philosophy of our day, we could summarize it very simply, which says what? I have to be true to myself. In other words, the most, in a Canadian, North American context, the most virtuous thing you could do today. Oh, doesn't it sound sweet? The most virtuous thing you can do is to be true to yourself. And to do anything other than to be true to yourself is really, it's almost immoral. Well, we do not want this man to be our king. And then we pick it up now as we get into chapter 2. A man of the tribe of Levi married a Levite woman. She became pregnant, gave birth to a son. When she saw he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. By the way, again, just take a look at that for a moment. Just read it. Some of your translations say, what? That she saw that he was no ordinary child. Now, I want you to think as moms. Does that sound a little odd? Have you ever, I mean, think of it for a minute. Have you ever dared walk up to a new mother and say, my, that's an ordinary child? Right? No. So even if the child is really not the most attractive, you say, oh, isn't she beautiful? I mean, he's the most lovely baby I've ever seen in my life. And so on. Why? I mean, come on. So is that what she's saying? In other words, was Moses' mother, she's looking and saying, all right, let me assess him for a moment. And she's looking at other babies, and she's looking at him, and she's kind of tabulating and figuring it out. And, oh, I know, he's not ordinary. He's fine, therefore, I'm going to spare him. What is talking about? Remember we talked about how in Exodus we have this theme coming up over and over, God causing his people to multiply and to flourish. We see it's as though all of the activity of creation in Genesis is just going on, and the people of God are multiplying in spite of all of the things that are against them. And the word could be translated robust and healthy. It also could simply be translated when she saw that the child was good. God looked upon everything that he had made, and what did he say? It is good. Now, it also could mean, and I do like this understanding of it, it also could mean that she looked on this child and somehow she had this sense, and I don't know whether it came from revelation of God to her directly, but somehow she looked at Moses, this little baby, and she recognized that there was something about him. It was not his physical appearance. It wasn't these kind of things that caused her to save his life. I mean, she's a mother. But she saw him as made in the image of God and having great value. But she also probably had a little sense in her heart that there was more to this than she realized. Look at verse 3. She could not hide him any longer. She got a papyrus basket for him, coated it with tar and pitch. She placed the child in it, put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen. By the way, the word for basket is only used in one other place. You know what it refers to? It was the ark. Remember the account of Noah and the ark? So in a sense, you have not only the recapitulation of the theme of creation going on over and over and over, but you also have this theme of God rescuing. And this little baby is put into a little ark. It's a miniature, in a sense, of what God did earlier when he saved Noah and his entire family. And so we have this going on. And we have the sister looking out and so on. It's a fascinating story. Pharaoh's daughter comes down. I'm going to just summarize. You can see the text, but just to move it along quickly. She sees this. Notice in verse 6, she opened it. He's crying. She felt sorry. And she knows this is one of the Hebrew babies. Now, this is an interesting thing because when you think of it, who is she? I mean, she's Pharaoh's daughter. What did Pharaoh say that everybody must do? He gave an edict to all of the Egyptians. If you see a baby boy, a Hebrew boy, you throw him in the Nile. That's just the way it is. Well, what are you going to do if it's your own daughter who is disobeying an order? And some scholars, I think it's an interesting perspective, some scholars say that Pharaoh's daughter, by disobeying her father, in a sense, invalidated the edict. And so not only did this result in the sparing of Moses, but ultimately resulted in the end of that murderous plan of Pharaoh. So we're seeing this remarkable story of God's intervention. And notice again, the sister in verse 7. What a brilliant thing. I mean, my goodness, what a wise girl, right? And what does she do? She says, look, would you like a wet nurse? Can I find one for you? Knowing full well who she's going to find. And, of course, you know what happens. She finds the child's mother. Verse 10, the child grew older. She took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses. By the way, that's the name Moshe. Does that ring a bell? Now, what does Moshe mean? Well, Moshe in the Egyptian language simply meant is born. But it also sounds like a Hebrew word, which means what? Verb to draw out. Which in a sense is now what? Every time the Hebrews would hear that name Moses, the Egyptians wouldn't get it, but the Hebrews would. And they would realize that he was drawn out of the water, but he's the one who is what? Going to draw out the people out of Egypt. He's going to draw them out of the Red Sea and rescue them when Pharaoh's armies are in pursuit, and so on. Well, fast forward 40 years. 40 years later. By the way, you could divide the life of Moses into three parts. They're all 40 years. 40 years, first of all, what? 40 years just describes his birth and all of the years that he spends in Pharaoh's household, in the palace. 40 years he spends in the wilderness in Midian. We're not going to spend much time there this morning. And then 40 years as he delivers the people and as he develops and trains the nation and watches over them during the wilderness wanderings. And then he dies just as they're about to enter the promised land. We see the intervention of God. In chapter 2, I do want you to take time and read through as Moses is grappling, and we're going to look at this a little more next week. Moses has an identity crisis. He's born a Hebrew. He's in Pharaoh's court. When he's about 40 years of age, what does he see? He sees one of his own Hebrews
whose life is being threatened. Some people say that Moses was wrong to intervene in all of this. He was idealistic. He was impulsive. He decides he's going to rescue. Now, what the language is saying is that Moses is observed. He sees this, and this is not just a casual somebody slapping somebody in the cheek. But this Egyptian slave master was executing a beating that was so severe that it would almost, with a certainty, have resulted in his death. So Moses has a dilemma. What am I going to do? Do I save his life, or do I just simply not do anything at all? And he does intervene. And so from that point on, of course, Moses is a fugitive. So we've got all of these things that are going on in his life. He goes into Midian. He meets the priest of Midian. He marries the daughter, and he spends 40 years in what? Midian, in a desert area. Now, life has started to come to a degree of, let's say, normalcy for Moses. I mean, the shock, the culture shock must have been incredible. But now he's a shepherd. Life is good. He's got a wife. He's got family. It may not be the ideal, but he's kind of okay. It's safe. And this is where we pick up the text. Now we're in chapter 2, 23, and we're going to move into chapter 3. During that long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned in their slavery. They cried out, and their cry for help went up to God. God heard the groaning. He remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. He led the flock to the far side of the wilderness. They came to Horeb, the mountain of God, also referred later as Mount Sinai. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from the bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. And Moses thought, I will go and see this strange sight. Why the bush does not burn up. Remember we talked about three important days. Which day are we in? Day one is what? The day that you're born, right? Day two is the day that you have a personal encounter with God. Now, is it always going to be dramatic as it was here with Moses? Now, we look at this on the surface, and some of us think, oh, my, I need to have a burning bush experience, and we need to go to some place on our planet where people have had these great encounters with God and go through some kind of a ritual in order to do it. Now, what we need to recognize is that this was just an ordinary day for Moses. What's Moses doing? He's doing what he's always done. Moses has been 40 years in a desert. He knows every bush. He knows every outcropping of rock. He knows where every oasis is. He knows where all the cliffs are. He knows where the predators are. Moses, this is all just, this is his world. In other words, you and I don't have to go to Midian and don't have to go and have this same encounter as Moses does, that often God will speak in the ordinary events of your life, as you go to your job, as you are with your family, as you go out for a walk. It's really up to God how he chooses to do it. It can happen in church. It happens in lots of different settings. But he goes and it arouses this curiosity. The miracles are just a backdrop. They're just a way to get attention. Verse 4, the Lord saw, he'd gone over to look, and God called to him within the bush, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, here I am. By the way, a bush that is burning, that doesn't end up what? Burning up the wood, is a wonderful way of understanding the character of God. That Moses is having to recognize that God is not reliant on anything or anybody else, that God is totally other. And so that's what he's starting to experience. And he says, Moses, Moses, and Moses says, here I am. Do not come any closer. And God said, what? You know, take off, he said, your sandals. For the place where you're standing is holy ground.
And then he said, I am the God of Abraham, or your father, Abraham, Isaac, the God of Jacob, and so on. And then this is one, look at now, Moses says, hid his face. He's afraid to look at God. But now look at verse 7. This is one of the most profound scriptures in the whole Bible in terms of understanding who God is and how God relates to us. Our God is not a God who is remote, and not a God that is abstract, not just some kind of a God, you know, that people believe and have this kind of fuzzy idea. But notice this. The Lord said, I have seen. Look at all the verbs. I have indeed seen the misery of my people. I've heard them crying out because of their slave drivers. And I'm concerned about their suffering. And then in verse 8, I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land. Remember, a thief comes to steal, kill, and destroy. But what has God come to do? I've come to give you life and to give it abundantly. We have this picture right here. And then he describes the nations that they will dispossess. And now the cry in verse 9 of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing. Notice, I've seen, I've heard, and I've come down to help. You know what is astonishing? Not only the birth, we celebrate the day that we're born, but we need to have that second encounter. Now, it's going to be different. And I remember when I was 16 years of age. And it happens to all of us at various points. But the question I want you to think of is, have you had that deep personal encounter with God? Now, you and I know that what was happening to Moses was only ultimately a foreshadowing of what one day would be available to us in Christ. But you'll find it'll be a similar experience where you have that awareness of your own situation, your own desperation, your own awareness of sin and of guilt and of need. And someone, somehow, it's maybe as you read the scriptures or possibly it's as you're sitting in church, or some of your friend talks to you, or you just spend some time alone. And when I was 16 years of age, on a particular evening, on a Monday night at a youth group, where I had that encounter with God, and it wasn't just an encounter like some kind of spiritual experience, but that awareness that God has a name, and that His name is Jesus. And you have that recognition that God says, listen, I've heard your situation. I see what's going on in your life. And I've come down to help. In other words, don't try to figure it out all yourself. Don't think you can kind of, you know, just simply get by with trying to resolve your own issues, your own problems, and so on. And so now what happens is what? Moses now discovers who God is. And when I was 16, when I heard and understood this need to have a personal commitment to Christ, I'd been going to church on Sundays, a very liturgical, you know, kind of church. It wasn't doing anything for me. I believed in God. I don't think there was ever a time, even from pretty well birth, that I didn't have at least an awareness that there was a God. But that's all it was. It wasn't personal. It wasn't transformational. It didn't allow me or enable me to deal with the issues that I was dealing with as a 16-year-old. It had no ability to change me inwardly and allow me, for example, to get along with my dad or deal with other stuff I was dealing with during those days. But when someone explained the very simple message of who Jesus is, as He died on the cross for my sin, stuff that I had theoretically recognized before, but now it made sense. And I went off in a quiet space in a big house. And I got alone with God. And God broke my heart. And I confessed. And I got clean with God,
and I appropriated the forgiveness that was available through what Jesus did on the cross. You see, it's not enough just to have the first day. It's not enough to celebrate the day of our birth. It's not enough to know the reason why. The fact is, you really will not figure out the reason why you're here on this planet until you've come to that second day where you have that encounter with God. And notice what happened when Moses has now had this experience with God. And in verse 10, now God says to him, and notice the order, the commissioning happens after the transformation. He says, now go, I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? Lord, I tried that before, and it didn't work out very well. Now, next week, we're going to look at this whole thing of various excuses. We all have excuses. We all have reasons why we consider ourselves, let's say, unqualified, or we have all kinds of other things that we will try to use to justify not fully committing or fully yielding to what God calls us to do. And we're looking at that next week. But that's what happens with Moses. But the point I want us to see is this. Look at verse 12. God said, I will be with you. I will be with you right now. But then notice he gives him a promise that's looking way into the future. He doesn't tell him how he's going to get there, but notice what he does. He says, not only I will be with you, but he says, this will be the sign that it is I who have sent you. When you've brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. In other words, this mountain that we're on right now, this place where you're having this encounter with me and coming to understand who I am. He says, trust me, I'm going to be with you through the entire journey. You don't know what's going to happen. When I was 16 years old, do you think I had any sense? Well, no. But do you think I had any sense of what God was going to do with my life? I cannot tell you how clearly I determined in my heart and said to God, God, there are only two things. I don't want to stay in Regina, and I don't want to be a pastor. I'll do everything else. And he kept us in Regina a long time and called us back to Regina. By the way, Regina's a fine city. We grew to love it. Wonderful place. But I had my reasons. But the primary thing was, Lord, not on your life. I mean, I could sing, play the piano, but Lord, the whole idea that I'm going to stand up and have to talk, have to study, have to preach. And I don't say this to brag. I just want you to recognize, some of you might look at me or look at others and you think, oh, it just must come so easily. But sometimes you have no idea how difficult it was, number one, to be willing, and let alone, Lord, this is the step of faith. I have no idea how this is going to turn out. And in your life, I'm not saying you're going to be doing what I'm doing. But the point is this, that we don't know how God is going to call us. We have no idea. And often the things that you feel least qualified to do, sometimes there's a wonderful intersection between your abilities and God's call in your life. And often that's the case. But sometimes God surprises you and surprises us and puts us in places and situations where you feel morally unqualified or intellectually unsuited, or you have all of these reasons why you're not able to do it. And all the Lord says is, listen, you got to trust me in this. All you really need right now, you don't need to know what the future holds. All you need to know right now who is in charge, I am with you. I am with you. If you're facing a tough decision, you're facing challenges, maybe it's in your family life, it's in your personal life, maybe it's at work, maybe it's in a relationship, or maybe it's a sin you're trying to get through or get over, and there's all this stuff, and we constantly are struggling with these issues.
And what God is simply saying is, listen, don't worry about the future. You know, don't worry about tomorrow. I mean, it sounds a little bit like, boy, it sounds almost like what Jesus says. Don't worry about tomorrow. You know, every day has enough kind of issues of its own, right? Trust me. Trust me. I am with you. And you know, you will one day worship me on this mountain. The day will end. And I wish I could guarantee you and say, oh, the healing's going to come and all of that. And maybe if you give me enough money, I will tell you that, okay? No, I can't tell you that. But I can tell you who was with you, and I can tell you that God says, listen, if you put your faith and trust in me, if you're willing just to go all out and fully be yielded, he says, look, you will one day worship me on this mountain. Now, that mountain is way off in the future. It might be that city and, you know, whose builder and maker is God. But God's promises are still valid, and he's still going to get you there. You see, Moses, his birth, yes, miraculous, incredible how God worked and intervened in the years in Midian. But the day of your birth is significant. But you have to have. Some of you might say, well, I grew up in a Christian setting and I've never not believed in God. And that's okay. I'm not disputing that. But there still must be a day, even in a case like that, there are those moments when you personally appropriate it. And you say, yes, Lord Jesus, I reaffirm that you are my Savior. I reaffirm that you are my Lord, that you're the master of my life. I reaffirm that, yes, you died on the cross for me, that you rose again from the dead. And we have those deep encounters with God. We must have those in our lives. The day of your birth, the day of that encounter with God, and then we understand the reason why. For what does Peter say? He says it beautifully, far better than I. Verse 9 of chapter 2. You are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, what? Why? That you may declare the praises of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Moses, I've heard the cry of my people. I've seen their misery. And I've come down to help. Now go. I'm sending you to Pharaoh. And you're going to go and say to Pharaoh, Pharaoh, you've had him long enough. Pharaoh, you got to let him go. I don't know how that's going to apply in all of our lives. It certainly applies very literally in the sense of evangelism. That's our role. That's our job. Your passion can be expressed in your work and so on, but can we see in that not only that this is my passion and what I like to do, but can we see it as the place that God has called us, the place where we get to represent him as his ambassadors, as salt and as light?